Hi, everybody. I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. Last August, 23-year-old Corinne Gaines and a Baltimore County police officer pointed guns at each other for nearly 6 hours in an apartment in Randallstown. The incident ended when they shot at each other. Miss Gaines died. She could have surrendered, but what could the officer have done to avoid this tragic outcome? Are police adequately trained to defuse tense situations like this one? Can anyone who hasn't walked in the shoes of a police officer ever understand the intense dynamics of a situation in which two people are at an armed standoff for hours? Today on Midday, training to avoid tragedy. Two former cops and the director of the NYPD Police Studies Program join me to talk about what police know and what they could know to help them de-escalate life-threatening situations. First, the news. Welcome to Midday, everybody, on 88.1 WIPR. I'm Tom Hall. Before we start today, I want to give you an update on the terrible bus crash, a crash that occurred this morning about 7 o'clock in the 3800 block of Frederick Avenue in Southwest. Crash involved a school bus and an MTA bus. Kenneth Burns from the WIPR News Department reporting that six people were killed in that accident. The driver of the school bus plus five people who were on the MTA bus. No children were killed in this accident. 10 have been injured. One is in critical condition currently at shock trauma. According to T.J. Smith, the spokesperson for the Baltimore City Police Department, the yellow school bus was traveling eastbound on Frederick Avenue. It struck a car, which propelled it into oncoming traffic, and then it struck the bus. Kenneth Burns will have more on this terrible accident and this terrible tragedy this afternoon during All Things Considered here on 88.1. Today we're going to remember another tragic incident that left one woman dead, her 5-year-old son wounded, and lots of questions about how this kind of tragedy might be avoided in the future. Back in August, Baltimore County Police shot and killed a 23-year-old woman named Corinne Gaines. Police went to Miss Gaines' apartment, to serve a failure to appear bench warrant and a warrant for her boyfriend who fled the scene. Police say after gaining access to the apartment, they found Gaines with her son sitting on the floor, pointing a long gun in their direction. Police then barricaded themselves in the hallway and, quote, made every effort to talk to the woman and encourage her to surrender peacefully, unquote. These efforts included calling Ms. Gaines' father to the scene to help to convince her to surrender. About 6 hours into the standoff, police say Ms. Gaines pointed her gun at an officer and said, if you don't leave, I'll shoot you. Police said that an officer fired one shot and missed, prompting Ms. Gaines to fire her weapon twice. Her shots missed the officers. Police then fired three more times, killing Corinne Gaines. Her son was also shot in the melee by an officer. He did not sustain life-threatening injuries. In September, the Baltimore County State's Attorney, Scott Schellenberger, announced that he would not file charges against the officer involved. Ms. Gaines' family has a pending wrongful death lawsuit against Baltimore County and some of the officers involved in the shooting. Ms. Gaines is one of several armed or even unarmed suspects who have come into contact with the police and ended up dead or seriously injured. Today on Midday, a conversation about the training police receive to help them defuse situations like this before they end in death for either suspects or the police. What are the protocols when it comes to using deadly force against somebody? Do the policies our police departments follow emphasize de-escalation, and is there a particular culture of policing that contributes to when an officer decides to use deadly force? Coming up a little later, we'll talk to the former police chief of Seattle, Washington, and a former police officer in Washington, D.C., who now teaches criminal justice and heads the D.C. Autism Society. But first, it's my pleasure to welcome Dr. Maria Haberfeld. She's a professor in the Department of Law and Police Science and Criminal Justice Administration at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York. She's also the co-director of the NYPD Police Studies Program there. She joins us on the phone from New York. Dr. Haberfeld, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
So in 2015, a total of 991 people were killed by the police. And in this current year, to date, 793 people have been killed by the police. 186 of those killed this year had a known mental illness. We should point out that most were white. 180 of them were black men, and 15 of those black men were unarmed. We've been hearing a lot about unarmed black civilians being killed by police over the last couple of years. Statistics like this often obviously paint a sort of a fragment of a very complex and nuanced picture. Can you put these numbers in context for us? I mean, are these numbers higher than what we've seen before? Are we just simply more aware of police shootings than we were before?
No, I don't think that they're higher. I just think that we are more aware because of the various media, social media outlets, and the involvement of media in this event. There is also more accountability and transparency as far as police organizations are concerned in the last few years. So there's just more focus on police work. But police work is something that involves the use of deadly force, and this is something that we authorize as citizens of this country. So if you think about having, you know, over 800,000 police officers armed on a daily basis on the streets of the cities and other environments in the United States, then you can put it within the context of the numbers. Although, you know, I always say every life that's lost, it's a life that's lost. So it's hard for me to talk just about the numbers.
Certainly, every life is lost, as you say, is definitely lost. In terms of how you study this as a scholarly pursuit, is there a lot of data about this? I'm under the impression that perhaps there isn't as much as we'd like.
No, there isn't, and the FBI is currently working on some sort of mechanism to compile use of deadly force by our 18,000 police agencies around the country, but I don't think they'd be able to mandate it for each and every agency, but certainly we're going to get more of an insight into not just use of deadly force that generates the fatal outcomes, but also other types of shootings that involve police and the citizens, and then we'll have a better understanding of circumstances and the outcomes.
So the numbers that I quoted you came from the Washington Post, 991 people killed in 2015, 793 people killed so far in 2016. Do you trust that data? I mean, the data that the public media is collecting?
In general, I don't trust data, even the ones that's collected by state and official agencies like the Department of, you know, of Justice that generated some sort of a document 3 years ago about state and local law enforcement training academies in 2013, because all these numbers are always adjusted based on the lack of responses from agencies. So, you know, it makes sense given the fact that we have 800,000 police officers and 18,000 agencies, but it could be very well more than that or actually less.
So there's a group called the Police Executive Research Forum.
PERF.
And it's an independent organization, and they focus on all issues critical to policing. Their membership includes virtually every police department serving large metropolitan areas, I mean, 50,000 residents or more.
Yeah.
They've issued 30 guiding principles on the use of force. Are these principles, these de-escalation guidelines and policies, are they effective in your view in terms of attenuating, you know, making fewer the number of lethal force incidents that we have?
So let me just put it also within the context of another document that was just released by PERF in October that's called ICAT, which is Integrating Communication Assessment and Tactics. And this is supposedly a training guide for diffusing critical incidents. So when I look at these two documents together, and again, maybe one of the critical points is that PERF really relies on large police agencies, but overwhelming majority of police departments in the United States are actually very small, 50 sworn officers and below, so they are not necessarily members of PERF. But when I'm looking at these two documents, one of the things that really makes me very worried from the perspective of law enforcement, but also, of course, the public, is that one of the recommendations is in this new document to look beyond the presence of a weapon, that the officer should be looking beyond the presence of the weapon and consider the what is the subject doing with the weapon, primarily when we're dealing with knives and other tools, not necessarily dangerous weapons, not necessarily guns. But for me to ask police officers to look beyond the presence of a weapon is a very dangerous precedent. About 7% of people who are actually killed by the police or come to some sort of a deadly interaction with the police are emotionally disturbed people, which means that the police officers are not necessarily able to assess what kind of behavior is going to evolve. And then going back to the 30 principles, in general, when you give somebody 30 principles to look at, in my experience, after looking at the first 10, they probably will stop looking any further. When we deal with an evolving threat in the field, on the streets, somebody's swinging a bat at you, somebody's pulling a knife, this person, in your assessment, has some sort of a mental problem, mental issue, I don't necessarily think that the 30 principles will be very helpful in dealing with this present and evolving danger.
I mean, none of us who are not police officers can really realistically imagine what it must be like to be in a situation like that. But of course, it's not only the stress of that particular incident, that particular situation the officer finds him or herself in. It's also the fact that, like all of us, people, police officers, have stress in their lives in general, right? You've done a little research on this.
And this is something that I've been advocating now for almost 20 years. Police officers need to receive, before any other type of training, stress management training. Because police officers experience, see, sense things on a daily basis that very few other professions are exposed to. And to assume that they just go home and, you know, take off the uniform and everything disappears is a very irresponsible thing on the part of our society. And to me, before we compile a list of 30 principles of how to de-escalate, how to move, how to maintain certain distance, we owe it to our police officers to give them the tools to manage the daily stress, the accumulation of the stress, which will allow them to assess the dangerous situation in a much more effective way without the need to memorize the 30 principles.
You have taken a look, I think, at Baltimore's new use of force policy. It went into effect last July. What's your opinion of that?
Well, first of all, it's a little bit disturbing to me when there is suddenly this idea pushed out there that police officers should be aware of the sanctity of human life. I think police officers were always aware of the sanctity of human lives, of the human life they are charged to protect and their own. So to suddenly put it out there as if until now human life didn't matter so much to police officers is very misleading. And I will tell you why it's important to me to focus on this. Because when you're offering new training to police officers who are already trained and you start pointing to issues and concepts that sort of assuming that they were not there before, that they were disregarding the human life, you already alienate the audience. And when you alienate the audience, and I'm speaking right now as a college professor with over two decades of teaching, if I alienate the students with my handouts, with whatever I say, I realize very quickly that they just stop listening to me. And this is part of the problem that I see with Baltimore's new policy for use of force, and also this entire, again, awareness that suddenly appears to be codified on various pages and training manuals that was always there. I've been looking at training, as I said before, for almost three decades now. There was always awareness of sanctity of human life. Deadly force was always emphasized as the last resort. And what was missing throughout the years, among other things, was really the stress management training, the communication training that for many police departments ends with a couple of hours during the police academy training. It's not necessarily the use of force that police officers were training in a defective or defective way, although I did see it in terms of lack of inclusion of emotional and psychological impact of use of force and physiological impact of use of force. But primarily the deficiency of police training was in lack of proper communication training, proper police community relations training, various social themes and topics that we teach our students at the university, but we don't necessarily include at police academies. So as much as I'm happy that there is an awareness now about the way police officers are trained, I still feel that we are missing the basic principles that need to be incorporated into the training before we move into various adjustments in the use of force policies.
Dr. Maria Haberfeld is professor in the Department of Law and Police Science and Criminal Justice Administration at the John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York and the co-director of the NYPD Police Studies Program. Dr. Haberfeld, thank you so much for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up, a conversation with cops who have been on the front lines. Retired Seattle Police Chief Norm Stamper is on the advisory board of LEAP, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. It's a group that works to change drug laws, and the author of To Protect and to Serve, How to Fix America's Police. Ronald Hampton teaches criminal justice at the University of the District of Columbia and serves as the president of the D.C. Autism Society. He served on the Metropolitan Washington, D.C. Police Force for 23 years. They'll join me after a break. You can join us as well. Our number, 410-662-8780. Our email address, midday@wipr.org. You can find us on Twitter, @MiddayTomHall. Thanks for being with us. Stick around.
This is your NPR news station, 88.1 WYPR, where you're listening to Midday.
And welcome back to Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us. Coming up later this week, our movie mavens, Jed Dietz and Ann Hornaday, will be here. They're coming on Friday, and they'll talk about the latest in cinema. And on Thursday, the head of the City Board of Elections, the Deputy State Administrator for Elections, and John Willis, a former Maryland Secretary of State, join me to talk about the problems that some precincts encountered during the primaries and what voters can expect on Election Day. That's a week from today. And by the way, tomorrow on Midday, a conversation with Baltimore State's Attorney Marilyn Mosby about her proposals to reform the way police officers are held accountable when they are accused of misconduct. We'll also touch base with Keisha Brown, who oversees the Civilian Review Board. Today, our focus is also on the police and how they are trained to respond in intense situations that most of us, frankly, can't begin to imagine. I'm pleased to welcome to the program two gentlemen with extensive experience in law enforcement. Norm Stamper had a career that spanned 34 years. He was the police chief in Seattle, Washington, until he retired in 2000. Before that, he served in the San Diego Police Department. He's the author of two books, the latest of which is called To Protect and to Serve, How to Fix America's Police. Chief Stamper is on the advisory board of LEAP, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, and he joins us on the phone from Seattle. Welcome to the show, sir.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
Ronald Hampton was a Washington, D.C. Metropolitan Police officer for 23 years. After he retired in 1994, he served as the executive director of the National Black Police Association. Today, he teaches criminal justice at the University of the District of Columbia and serves as the president of the D.C. Autism Society. He joins us on the phone from Washington. Mr. Hampton, welcome, sir.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much.
You can join us as well here on Midday. Our phone number, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. And you can find us on Twitter, @MiddayTomHall. Mr. Hampton, let me start with you. The scholar we just spoke to, Dr. Maria Haberfeld in New York, noted that in the Baltimore police newly revised use of force policy, she took umbrage at the fact that sanctity of life was respect for the sanctity of life was not automatically assumed on the part of police officers, and it was mentioned right in the preamble to the policy. But we've just seen a DOJ report, a Department of Justice report about policing over the past several decades here in Baltimore. We are about to enter into a consent decree, and there's information in that DOJ report that indicates that in certain instances there were officers here in Baltimore who did not appear to have much respect at all for the sanctity of life. As a career police officer, where do you think that stands in terms of the national scene, at least, and the problems that particularly communities of color are encountering with police departments across the country?
Well, I think the first of all, let me say thank you for having me. And
we're delighted.
She said a lot of things that with some I disagree with, but this here, this sanctity of life thing, she thought that was wrong because they have always had, it's a given that they have respect for the sanctity of life. If they did, then we wouldn't have seen the kind of things that the DOJ report has documented. If they had respect for the sanctity of life, they wouldn't have been violating people's rights and as it relates to the Fourth Amendment and other things as it relates to what the police were doing in that community. I mean, one of the things that DOJ does, the Special Litigation Division, that when they launch these reports, they actually go out on occasion. They even would ride with police officers and while police officers do their job, the investigators actually witness. They were actually in the scout car and witnessed police officers violating people's rights in the face of these DOJ investigators. They were actually continuing this. So this notion that the Baltimore City Police officers, as well as some of the other police departments, have a respect for the sanctity of life is not necessarily true. If they do, then I would think that if that was a given, we wouldn't be witnessing the kind of things that we're witnessing as it relates to the behavior of police officers and citizens. So, I definitely don't necessarily agree with that. I mean, I've watched police officers myself when I was on the police office, when I was on the police department, rather, who didn't necessarily have a respect for sanctity of life. I mean, the way they talked, and those who talked a certain way were the ones who got involved in situations doing the tour of duty. Those were the ones. So, you know, those are the kind of things that I think maybe she may be talking about. Certainly certain police officers, as a police officer myself, I definitely had respect for the sanctity of life. But there were a lot of police officers I worked with who didn't necessarily, in my opinion, have respect for the sanctity of life. Sure. Or just a human being.
Sure.
Didn't have it.
And Chief Stamper, of course, we had an officer, a former Baltimore police officer, a man named Michael Wood, said that the Baltimore use of force policy, which went into effect on July 1st, is really nothing new. I mean, is this an issue, in your opinion, of training? I mean, can you train a person to remember policies, whatever they are, if they are in situations that are intense and dynamic and quickly changing and in which they fear for their lives?
Well, training is essential. Quality training, relevant training, presented effectively, of course, that's essential. But it's absolutely insufficient. What I think is missing from the national conversation is a recognition that the very structure of American policing has produced a culture of policing whose members, too many of them, certainly not all, do not value the sanctity of human life, do not value their fellow Americans' civil liberties, and as a consequence, behave in ways that undermine trust and that result in tragedies. I would submit to you that the officer who shot and killed Laquan McDonald in Chicago lacked any kind of value for human life. Likewise, the officer in North Charleston, South Carolina, who shot a fleeing Walter Scott in the back in a very casual fashion, was sending a graphic message in each of those cases that they didn't care for the sanctity of human life at all.
So is it a matter of weeding out people before they're accepted into the police academy, of doing analysis of a person's general psychological makeup? Or can you, in fact, if someone, you know, enters police work not valuing the sanctity of life, can she or he be trained to value human life? It seems like a pretty basic thing, doesn't it?
Well, I agree with you. I think it is a very basic thing, and this is oftentimes overlooked as well. We're doing a fairly good job at our selection process these days, much improved over what it was, for example, when I was hired as a San Diego beat cop in ancient times back in 1966. We have added psychological screening, we've reinforced background investigations, and those agencies, those jurisdictions that pay attention to the standards necessary to do a good selection process are doing just that. So the question we have to ask is what happens to these well-intentioned people who want to give back to their communities, who are motivated to do good and to do well? What happens to them? And I think we're not adequately addressing that question.
Yes, sir. And if I could, I agree wholeheartedly with what the chief has said. The other thing that I would add to it is this notion that once we have them on the police department and we recognize that they don't have respect for the sanctity of life, that they don't respect basic human and civil rights people, then we need to get rid of them. We don't need to play with them. We need to get rid of them. And that provides two functions, at least two, at the very least. That is, we get rid of them, and then it sets an example for those who would even attempt to even think about following in the footsteps of those kind of officers, that we are not going to tolerate that. See, the culture that the chief is talking about has also permeated that part and component of it, too. So, you know, they go, and they also move from department to department, because that was the case in the shooting of the young man in Cleveland, had been at another police department where he had been let go because of his inability to handle situations in a mature way. And then he ends up in the Cleveland Police Department. Now, all of a sudden, he shoots the 12-year-old kid in Cleveland. So, you know, once there's an example demonstrated, then we need to get rid of those people.
That's retired police officer Ronald Hampton. He teaches criminal justice at the University of the District of Columbia and heads the D.C. Autism Society. He's on the phone from Washington. Retired Seattle Police Chief Norm Stamper also joins us. His latest book is called To Protect and to Serve, How to Fix America's Police. He's on the line from Seattle. Chief Stamper, as I understand it, there are some police departments who don't buy into this notion that we need to increase training in diffusion and de-escalation tactics. Do you have a sense that there is a national consensus that that's a good idea, or is this something that certain police departments are still in need of convincing of?
Well, there's a growing consensus that it's necessary, but certainly, as you've pointed out, there are those agencies and those police unions and those individual officers who will tell you that de-escalation training is jeopardizing the safety of their officers. What I would suggest is the absence of de-escalation jeopardizes their safety as well as the safety of the public.
Why is it, Professor Haberfeld from NYU or from John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York, says that there is a paucity of data. So studying this is actually very difficult. And she identified one of the problems that there are police departments who don't report incidents that involve lethal force. Why is that? Chief Stamper, why is there a resistance to that?
Because essentially of home rule, our commitment to it from the earliest stages of our history to states' rights and home rule. We would claim from San Diego to New York City, from Ferguson to Detroit, you name it, that those agencies are authorized in law to set their own standards, to establish their own policies, to provide their own training. And if you stop and think about it for a second, now policing is one of the most demanding and delicate and indeed dangerous jobs, and we have no national standards for its operation. I'm advocating the creation of binding national standards that would certify every police officer and indeed every law enforcement agency in the land. And as Ron was pointing out, if you have a police officer in Independence, Ohio, who falls apart on the police pistol range, is effectively terminated by that agency and then hired effectively 5 minutes later by the Cleveland Police Department without benefit of a background investigation, And then, as Ron made very clear, kills a lonely 12-year-old boy on a snowy field in Cleveland some couple of years later. It really does cry out for the development and the enforcement of defensible standards for procedural justice. Stop and frisk, search and seizure, laws of arrest, and certainly use of force, including lethal force.
And Mr. Hampton, I think a lot of people in the case of Corinne Gaines in Baltimore County, there was a standoff there in that incident that lasted well more than 5 hours, almost 6 hours. My thought when I first heard about the tragic outcome of that is why, after 5 or 6 hours, was the situation different? Why couldn't it have been extended to 8 hours or 10 hours? Or why didn't something like that happen after the second hour or the third hour? Do you have some insight as to what happens when a situation sort of drags on for a while and you've got this confrontation and what officers perhaps could have done, what other options they had besides firing their weapons at that juncture? Mr. Hampton, are you there, sir?
Oh, yes, sir. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Yeah. No, I believe in a process by which that they had all day and all night to wait. I mean, that's the whole idea, is to, if you have a hostage situation and you find yourself in it, the idea is to get out of the situation with the witnesses and as well as the person with the gun, that they get out of it safely. What was happening that they had to rush the process? The woman had a gun, a long rifle or what they call a long gun. She wasn't doing anything with it. And she had made some statements in reference to it. She was standing there with a child. So the child was innocent in the sense that he happened to be in there, but he wasn't presenting a threat to anyone. So in my opinion, the officers could have waited for as long as they needed to wait in order to safely, in order that everyone could walk away from that situation safely. So the officers could have taken a safe position and not endangered themselves as a result of the lady having the long gun, and then just waited until the situation resolved itself, and then everybody would have walked away from it.
Yeah, according to Chief, according to the Baltimore County Police, the police officer did fire first. We have a caller in Arbutus who isn't on the line, but he asks, why would the police take more time to shoot Joseph Palczynski, which was another very celebrated case that happened in Baltimore County? He had already killed people, and that standoff lasted 16 hours. Why is it that you think the officers, I mean, obviously Ms. Gaines had threatened the officers and said, if you don't leave, I'll shoot. But what other options did that officer have in that very tense situation at that moment besides pulling the trigger of a gun?
Well, let's give the officers credit for not shooting her for those first 5 or 6 hours. Police officers are taught to win. They're taught to control. They're taught to insist that everyone they interact with play by their rules. And what happened on this case, and I'm judging this from a very far remove, and I apologize for it, jumping to any conclusions, but what I'm speculating is that she essentially asserted a new set of rules. And they allowed that to happen. She said, if you don't leave, I'm going to shoot you. And, you know, a very carefully thought out, very disciplined, very well-trained a group of officers engaging in that operation would say, wait a minute, she hasn't shot at us yet. We have a safe distance away. We're a safe distance away from her. We can always find additional cover. We can be deliberate. We can slow things down, which is, of course, a very important de-escalation skill. Just slow things down. Talk in soothing terms. Police officers don't like to hear that kind of talk, but it's necessary. When you hear a police officer yelling and screaming at someone, you're thinking, well, they think they're exercising control. In fact, they're losing control. So they could have, perhaps, simply backed away further, gotten themselves out of sight, and maintained communication with her. I couldn't agree more that time is an ally of officers who are using tactical means to try to extract somebody from a dangerous situation.
Retired Seattle Police Chief Norm Stamper, his latest book is called To Protect and to Serve, How to Fix America's Police. He's on the advisory board of LEAP, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. Joining us on the line from Washington, D.C., retired police officer Ronald Hampton. He teaches criminal justice at the University of the District of Columbia, and he heads the D.C. Autism Society. We'll have more on police training and de-escalation techniques when we come back after a quick break. You are welcome to join our conversation here on Midday. 410-662-8780 is our phone number. Midday at WIPR.org is our email address, and you can send us a tweet at Midday Tom Hall. Glad you're with us. Stay with us.
Tune to your NPR news station, 88.1 WYPR.
And welcome back. Glad you are with us here on Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, we're talking about the training that police receive to help them de-escalate potentially fatal situations. Retired police officer Ronald Hampton teaches criminal justice at the University of the District of Columbia. He's on the line from Washington. Chief Norm Stamper served in law enforcement for 34 years, including 6 years as the chief of police in Seattle. His latest book is called To Protect and to Serve, How to Fix America's Police. You can join us here on the program. Give us a call at 410-662-8780. Drop us an email, midday at wypr.org, or send us a tweet. Our handle is at Midday Tom Hall. Glad to hear from Pastor Walter Braxton, who sent an email. He says, I'm a 53-year-old black male who realized that I, on any given day, might be the victim of a police misunderstanding, which would place my life in danger. With that said, I'm so glad that folk are beginning to see that the officers need more training, not more critique on the bad job they might be doing. Thank you, Pastor, for that email. And Mr. Hampton, mental health is a big dimension in many of these instances. One of the guidelines of PERF, this organization we talked about earlier in the show, says that we need to implement a comprehensive agency training program on dealing with people with mental health issues. Right. Is it possible to train folks who are not trained as, you know, psychiatrists or psychologists to deal with a person in crisis?
Yeah, I don't know. I really don't. And although I would like to see police officers get more education, training and education are very different. But I would like to see them get more education around mental health issues and then also partnership with mental health professionals. I happened to be at the White House last month when the mental health community was there talking about police and mental health encounters. And the mental health professionals, before they left there, had concluded that they wanted to get the police out of the business of responding to mental health situations, and that mental health professionals should do that. That they also talked about that there are several examples in the country where mental health professionals are tied into the 911 system, so they respond and the police respond too, but the police lay back because they are not trained or educated the way mental health professionals are in handling these situations. And you noted that I'm in the Autism Society, and I have a son that's 32. He's about 6 feet, weighs about 220 pounds. He's a big guy. And having been a police officer, if we were to call the police or somebody called the police and he was having an episode, he has this thing where he throws his arms in the air and all of this. So in this present environment, being 220 pounds and 6 feet tall, and throwing his arms in the air, most police officers responded would see that as a threat and shoot my son because that's how they're trained. So if they're educated about autism and the behavior of people with autism on the spectrum and the do's and don'ts, then I think maybe that would be different. But see, a mental health professional is already educated about that because that's part of the process. So in our organization, we don't necessarily support the notion that when my son is having the episode that you call the police because he may end up dead.
So, Mr. Hampton and Chief Stamper, I'd like you to take a couple of calls from some listeners. Dennis in Baltimore, you're on Midday with Chief Norm Stamper and Ron Hampton.
Good morning.
Thank you for taking my call. I agree that training is necessary, but we don't have a discussion about there's different individuals that make up the police department. Every policeman is not going to respond to situations the same. Some individuals are waiting for the opportunity for the fight or to shoot at someone, and that's their makeup. There's the same. That's the same kind of individual that plays football. Somebody goes overboard because they enjoy doing that. And there's no psychological tests. There's no evaluation. And there's no training that's going to address that. I think the only thing that comes close to what was been talked this morning is once you identify someone who has a behavior disorder that can't respond to situations in a way that it benefits everyone, and I'm lost for words right now, then you need to make sure that that person doesn't get into that in those situations again. The individual who killed the kid in Florida, who was a neighborhood security guard, had been rejected from police departments before because something came up to identify him as not safe to put on the streets with a gun and work with the public.
Right. Dennis, well, thank you for your call. I appreciate it. Chief, we have an email from Earl in Catonsville, Maryland, who says, I see two problems. Number one, police recruit heavily from former military personnel. And number two, the war on drugs has created in police forces across the country an us versus them mentality. If you're not a cop, then you're them. And your organization on which you serve on the advisory board, LEAP, is Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, and it deals specifically with drugs. Let's deal with the first point of Earl's email, the fact that so many former military personnel are attracted to police work. Is that an issue?
It can be an issue. I hate yes, no, and maybe answers, but that's the only one I can really provide. Some military veterans have said, okay, I'm done with war. I want to give back to my community. I'm disciplined. I'm patient. I'm skilled. I'm effective as a police officer, and I've seen that many, many times. I have also seen returning veterans who cannot turn it off. So what this all points to is the absolute need for very careful entry-level screening, a rigorous selection process, and then training, but with a willingness, as several of your commentators, including Ron, pointed out, is that is to show them the door if they show that they cannot or will not play by the rules. That there can be no place in a modern police department for a heavy-handed or trigger-happy police officer. And if I may, the issue about the drug war is just so important, and people say, well, what's that got to do with lethal force? Well, in 1971, when Richard Nixon proclaimed drugs or drug abuse public enemy number one and declared all-out war on them, he was really declaring war on his own people, especially young people and poor people and people of color. And since then, we have arrested, incarcerated tens of millions of nonviolent drug offenders. And we've made of our police officers foot soldiers in a war. You don't fight a war without an enemy. So that enemy has a young face, a dark face, and is oftentimes coming from a poor neighborhood. And so in the relationship between police and community, where there's the greatest strain, and then tragically the greatest history of oppression and neglect and abuse, we have police officers treating people like the enemy.
Jill sends us a tweet and says, the Corinne Gaines incident stemmed from a traffic violation. The fact that this escalated to a police standoff shows the overreach of the police and the government. Jacqueline also sends us a tweet. She says, police do need to be told to prioritize the sanctity of human life. It's much different than prioritizing serving warrants or ego. Mr. Hampton, is community policing the answer? If the police in Baltimore County had known Ms. Gaines a little bit better, and her family, by the way, has said that she did suffer from mental illness as a result of lead paint poisoning when she was a child, could that have made for a different scenario in this case, do you think?
Well, when I was on the police department, I walked a foot beat when I started, and then I got transferred, went to another foot beat, and I walked a foot beat for a long time. So I can tell you that knowing the people in your community, knowing the idiosyncrasies of your community, who lives in your community, what they're doing in their community, what are the issues in that community, there's definitely an advantage to it when it comes to protecting the community. So I would definitely agree with that. What I would tell you about community policing is, as much as we've talked about it, there are very few places that are actually doing it, because the institution of policing has a real short memory, and it takes a long time to really change a paradigm, a philosophy. See, community policing was a philosophy that sort of evolved, and it really meant changing policing, not only on the outside in terms of what policing do, what police officers do, but changing how you get police officers to do it, and the reason why they do it, and what the results of doing it will, how it will benefit not only the police department, but most of all benefit the community. So they didn't have the patience to go through the painstaking process for community policing to be fully implemented. So what we've had is conversation. We've had words thrown around that talk about community policing, but very few people are doing it. But as a foot police officer, it's definitely a value to know who lives in your community and what's going on in your community. That kind of information, there's no substitute for that kind of information if you're a good foot police officer. If you're a good patrol officer riding a car, that's valuable information.
All right, well, I'll try to squeeze in one more call before we finish the program today. And my apologies to everybody who's on hold. But Robert in Baltimore, you pick up on a point that Dr. Haberfeld made in the first segment of the program. Welcome to Midday.
Hi, thank you. My question is, how many mental health workers are there for the police themselves? A lot of officers put themselves in high-stress situations every day, just like our military, and probably the truth is they do not have a way to decompress. You know, have a beer actually talk to a mental health worker.
Yeah, that's a good point, Robert. That's a good point, Robert. And forgive me, I'm going to cut you off because we're running out of time. But Chief Stamper, are there mental health services provided for officers in any departments around the country, to your knowledge?
Generally, no. The exceptions are worth celebrating, they're worth identifying and replicating. But we have 18,000 police departments, the vast majority of which do not have access to continuing mental health services for police officers. The case having been made by your caller, I think, makes it abundantly clear that we need to do that.
Norm Stamper had a career in law enforcement that spanned 34 years, including 6 years as the chief of police in Seattle. He's the author of two books, the latest of which is called To Protect and to Serve, How to Fix America's Police. Chief Stamper is on the advisory board of LEAP, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. Chief, thank you so much for your time today. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Ronald Hampton was a police officer in Washington, D.C. for 23 years. After retiring in 1994, he served as the executive director of the National Black Police Association. Today, he teaches criminal justice at the University of the District of Columbia, and he serves as the president of the D.C. Autism Society. Ron Hampton, thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me, Mr. Hall.
We'll have more information about this very important topic on our website, wipr.org/midday. Coming up on the program tomorrow, more on police and public policy. We'll have Baltimore State's Attorney Marilyn Mosby here. She'll join me to discuss her 5-point plan to change the way in which police-involved lethal force incidents are investigated, how they're prosecuted, and how they are reviewed. We'll also check in with Keisha Brown of the Mayor's Office of Civil Rights and Wage Enforcement. That's the agency that oversees the Civilian Review Board, which handles citizen complaints against the police. That's all coming up tomorrow here on Midday. I'd like to thank Joe Squared for providing lunch today. Joe Squared serves coal-fired pizzas, risotto, and local craft beers. Locations and hours at joesquared.com. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks so much for spending part of your day with us here at Midday. We'll see you tomorrow. Have a great day.